Hello, this is Rachel Lynn, and you are listening to Upstage Left. It's been a little while since I released an episode. Since the pandemic, I feel like, what is time? And so I haven't been keeping to my schedule, but I'm so excited about this next episode. We actually recorded it at the end of April, so, you know, what feels like a decade ago now, and I've been sitting on it for 5 months because I so admire this guest. I've been waiting for the exact right time to release it. She is a Pulitzer Prize winner in drama for her play Cost of Living. Her other plays include Ironbound, Queens, and Sanctuary City. If you had asked me before I spoke with this person who is a dream guest on this show, she would be at the top of the list. Of course, I'm talking about Martina Majok. She's one of my personal heroes, I think, because we share similar childhood experiences. We're both immigrants who moved to the States at an early age, and we were raised by single moms. And the more I spoke to her, the more I felt connected to her. And so I'm really excited to share this episode with you. She's also just a badass. Here is Martina Majok. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, so good to chat with you again.
You too.
I feel really excited to talk to you. So what's been giving you comfort lately?
For a while, I was finding comfort in people's writing about taking compassion for yourself and that you don't have to be incredibly productive during this time. I think there was this, like, I mean, the Shakespeare wrote King Lear thing was completely not useful for me to hear, because it just put pressure on this time of a pressure that I always feel like I should be constantly working. And I appreciated people writing about how mental health is a real thing, and we don't have to kind of be in this productivity cycle that we've always been in, and perhaps this, like, taking a moment is actually good. And that was useful for a while. And then now actually doing some writing work is comforting to me, because it almost feels like once I was like, oh, I can have compassion for myself and not have to work, then I was like, oh, I'm inspired, which is very useful. Like, there's obviously so much tragedy and so much uncertainty around this time. And so anything that comes out of it that is like a positive thing, it feels strange to say that there's a positive aspect of it. But I think that this, like, pause moment is letting us kind of reassess how we've been living our lives up until now.
Totally.
And maybe there's some things that, you know, we encounter during this time that will translate into the way that we live our lives after this. Although I don't know that there's going to be an after this. I think it's going to be like and now with COVID.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
Do you think people will start writing about, do you think we'll start seeing COVID, more COVID plays, more apocalyptic plays?
I think we've been on an apocalyptic play kick for a while. But, like, I wonder if, like, every generation is like, well, we're the last ones. Like, this is it. It's just like the world's ending. Or if it is, like, especially now that we're like, oh yeah, no, things are definitely bad. I joke that we're gonna have a lot of, like, one person plays, like, in a bunker, or isolation. I'm like, people feverishly, like, washing their hands and things like that. But I'm curious to see, yeah, what comes out of it, because I suspect that probably us going into the past of and history of how we've transcended, I guess, certain periods that are like this are going to be more what we might see more of. But yeah, I'm sure there's going to be some. And hey, that may be great. I'm very curious too. I don't know how I could write about this right now, but I'm really curious to see if there are, like, a really inspiring COVID pandemic plays.
So you're from Jersey.
Yeah.
Central Jersey.
One of two places, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yes, of course. Yeah. Well, initially you're from Poland.
Yeah.
Yeah. How old are you when you came to the States?
I'm so troubled by that question when I get asked. I get asked that a lot.
Oh, really?
It's such a normal question. I think like when you are born in another country and then you have an American accent, people from the outside will be like, oh, well, that means that you're this. That means that you're only American. And if you like, and like depending on other people's rubrics for like what makes you enough of one thing or another, you know, I used to say like, oh, I'm Polish and I'm American. I mean, I have both citizenships. I have dual. I was naturalized here, and people would be like, oh no, you're American. And I'd get like hurt by that because I feel like it takes away from my connection to my family that's still back. My whole family's in Poland. My mom and my sister are just in America. And so then, and that's one of the questions of like, how old were you? Like, I just say young usually because I was young enough that I was not the one who was having to make the decision about immigrating. It was like, I came as my mom's child. It was me and her. We came over together, but I like resist saying my age. It's like on the internet. It's like, you know, like people could find it if they wanted to, but I resist saying it because it feels like it's going to be like, people are going to judge like, oh, well then she's this or she's that, or she's enough. When like, I kind of want to be able to define myself, you know?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I've never thought about that. You know, when I go abroad, I am a British passport holder and I don't have American citizenship. So when I go to, I was just in Lebanon last year and everybody was very confused because I had to be like, I'm a British citizen with an American accent and a Chinese face. Kind of how I explain myself.
Yeah. There's like no clear, you know, well, it's going to come with a story no matter what. Like these questions of, I think when you're like first generation or an immigrant or whatever, like, well, it's this and there's this. And I don't know. I don't mind that.
Yeah. Long story. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And where in Jersey? What was your childhood neighborhood like?
It was also mostly kind of multicultural, largely immigrant neighborhood. We lived like in the, most people know the area around Newark. And so around there, like Harrison, Kearney. I grew up primarily in Kearney, but we were kind of in that whole area of those towns. And it was working class, a lot of people were like had kids that were born here, but they came from another country. And I used to like notice that when we were like, a lot of the kids were learning to walk, like the parents were learning to speak English, like at the same time. And so I grew up around a lot of people for whom English was a second language.
And was English a second language for you as well?
I guess so. I mean, I was born in Poland. So I spoke Polish as my first language. And then though where I grew up was a multicultural area, it still had a large group of Polish immigrants there as well. We came during a period of a lot of migration out of Eastern Europe. And so I was speaking with this, like, I guess you'd call it the kind of diaspora of other Polish people, and then speaking Polish in the home. And then when I went to school, I didn't speak English really. My mom learned English on the job. She started working at a factory, and that's how she started learning English. And yeah, kind of like on the go.
Did you pick it up quickly? Was it like easy for you to start being English, or did it take a while?
I think so, because I liked school and I liked learning. I used to watch Mr. Rogers a lot because he enunciates so well. Yeah. And he's so sweet and kind. And so I would watch Mr. Rogers and just gather English from that way. And I do remember like going to, my mom tells me the story of that I went to like a playground and went up to a bunch of kids and started speaking Polish to them, and they like ran away because I didn't understand. They like didn't speak my language, which like Polish is a frightening language. It's a lot of consonants. So if someone's like speaking Polish to you, like what? And they ran away, and I was really sad. So I think that might have probably been like a mobilizing force for me to be like, okay, I gotta learn English. I want friends.
And did you in high school? Were you like a well-behaved teenager, or did you have a rebellious streak?
I loved school, but I was a mess as well. So I think two things could live together. I was rebellious. Although we didn't like grow up in a particularly like strict home. So I guess like my mom worked all the time. I was a latchkey kid, and we like, you know, had my sister's father, and my stepfather was like not the nicest person. And I kind of I guess my rebellion was I would like stay at other friends' places and kind of move in there because it was often difficult at my place and my mom wasn't home that often. So yeah, I like rebelled in that way, but I also like loved school and wanted the validation of doing well in school. And so I like lived in both worlds.
Did you go to public high school?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Public everything.
Is it kind of like a special program or was it just a normal high school?
I mean, it had like AP classes and things like that. I mean, aside from that, I think that was the closest special program was that it had like, you know, AP advanced classes, but nothing like specialized. Yeah. Just a general high school, public high school.
And so was it a big deal for when you got into, we've chatted, so I know some things. Was it a big deal when you got into UChicago?
Yeah, because that was also a period like where I was like doing really, I was really close to my mom at that point. Like, you know, like it's like, I think it's a teenager thing where you're like, this week I don't like you and this week I love you. She's like my best friend now. I love her very much. She was my best friend then too in ways. But again, my mom was super proud and happy, even though we didn't quite know what it meant. I was telling you before that I didn't really know what I was doing and applying for college. I sort of knew like, it's like what successful people do is they go to college. And so when I was in high school, I was like working a bunch of part-time jobs and just to survive and help, and was really busy and didn't have the means to go to visit universities. And so I went on like usnews.com and I looked at what the top 50 schools were. And I just kind of went down the list and was like, oh, Chicago, that sounds like a cool city. And I started like doing a little bit of, you know, they sent the brochure and I was like, ooh, life of the mind. Like, what is that? This? And I was like, the nerd in me was like a light. And so when I applied and got in as a scholarship kid, I was like, well, this is great. Like my mom was thrilled that I was going to be supported. But I like had no idea what I was getting into. Like private university. I didn't even actually know what a private university meant in that way. Like, I knew there was like Catholic school and I knew that there was public school, but like I learned about prep schools like later, that people went to boarding schools and prep schools. That was like a realization for me way late.
So was it like a culture shock when you got to Chicago?
I mean, yeah. I think I was like, oh, this is what class is. Like, there's like in the town I grew up in, I was like, oh, there was like a nicer part of town. And there was like another part of town, which was the part of town that I grew up in, which is the not quote unquote, not nice part of town. And like, that was what I thought kind of class was. And I guess in a sort of abstract way, like I knew my mom cleaned houses for like wealthier people. Maybe because I didn't interact with the people that were my peers, it seemed like just too abstract to me. And then when I sort of met people who'd come from these backgrounds there was a lot more security, financial security than what I had, and opportunities. It was fascinating, and also like felt lonely at times too.
Mm. And yeah. And I know you didn't declare a major, but you eventually ended up declaring English,
yeah,
literature.
Yeah, mostly because I just didn't know what to do. It would terrify me that I was like, I should go to college. I should go to a college I could afford. And ideally it would be like a college that people think is impressive, because again, I want validation. But it terrified me that I didn't know what to do. I took classes and things that I was interested in, and I had to do like a core program to, you know, like I took astrophysics and things like that, and I did very, very badly in it. I really wish I'd done better, but it wasn't. I saw myself taking a lot of theater classes and a lot of English classes, and so by the time it was time to declare, I was like, I guess I'm an English major. They didn't have a creative writing major or like a BA or BFA rather in theater. It was like theater studies or English. And so I did English, and I think I was one of the first people to get them to let me write a play for my thesis instead of like an academic paper.
That's amazing.
And then later on, they like had a creative writing program. I'm like, oh man, I wish I...
Oh really? They changed their...
Yeah, they got one. I was like, man, it was too late.
At that time. And what drew you to what drew you to the theater classes and drew you to the theater in the first place while you're out there?
Well, when I first got to school, I hadn't seen theater until sort of later than I think a lot of people see it. I'd seen it like my last year of high school, and I fell in love with it, and I wanted to just sort of explore. And it was like really close to when I was about to leave for school. Although like before then I hesitate to say I was doing theater, because it wasn't theater. I was working for this adult literacy program that would teach immigrant parents and their preschool age kids English together as an after school program. Mm. And we would write, there was a few students that would write these skits in different languages and in English that would give the participants kind of muscle memory language for things that they might encounter in life, like if they're going to the bank or if they were going to, you know, the cafe. And so I would write these and we would perform them, and I loved doing that. And so, but I was like, oh, that's, I didn't think of it as theater. And so when I got to Chicago, I like approached it was like the orientation week where there's tables and stuff for clubs that, you know, wanted to gain new members. And I went to the theater table, and I discovered that there was all of these people who've been doing theater all their lives. They'd like gone to theater camp and, you know, I didn't even know that there was a thing that was like theater camp. And so I was like, oh, this is, they like knew all the words, like they knew Dark Days, like we're, you know, teching, or like strike the table. And I was like, what is this? I don't know what you're saying. And so I was like, okay, this is not for me. Like, so I left. I didn't even like see a theater show my first year, because I felt like they would be like, imposter, the imposter is here. Like, she doesn't belong.
Theater kids are scary.
Yeah. They were like super, you know, hyper and like all like hugging and touching each other. And I was like, oh, that's cool. But then I just felt like I just didn't have their language. I guess I didn't know who Beckett was. Like, I just didn't know these things. So yeah, I stayed away, but I was depressed. I was sad. I felt lonely. Like for my first year in Chicago, because also I think part of, you know, you asked, was it a culture shock? And part of the culture shock is also like, I'd grown up with, you know, like domestic abuse and violence and, you know, various other like difficult things that I think, you know, when you're in it, you're just like, well, this is normal, or this is, you know, you just survived this, or a lot of other people are dealing with this. And so there's just, you know, understand that you get through it. And then mm-hmm. I think when you're out of that environment, I started to be like, oh, that was maybe a little troubling kind right. of what that all was.
Like unique to your experience or yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just sort of assessing and looking back and didn't really, yeah, I don't know. I didn't like having outlet to understand that. It was just sort of being away from it. It's like when you leave home, you sort of or come back or whatever, you sort of really see what it was when you're out of it. And I would go to the library a lot, because I'd always found solace in reading. And I found a collection of Sarah Kane's plays one day. I only picked it up because I liked the cover, mm-hmm. which was this cover of a little boy in Chechnya. And it was just like, he's looking straight into the camera, and it's like the frame of the photo is cut off at his right under his eyes, and like around him is just the rubble. And I was like, this is an amazing picture. Sarah Kane, oh, playwright, what? And I just started reading her collection, and there was something that really spoke to me in them. And I saw that the university was doing Crave. I'm doing her play Crave. And I was like, fuck it, I'm going to audition. I don't give a fuck. Like, worst thing that's going to happen is like, they'll say no. And like, I'll just be at the library again, whatever, fine. And so then I got in, and then I was part of the theater world, I guess, their group. And I was in a show every semester.
Oh, wow.
I did acting because it was just like the gateway drug to theater. I just didn't really know. It just seemed like, well, you want to be involved, you just be an actor. And I loved it. I loved the little family that you make when you're in the theater and when you're in rehearsal and when you're in tech and, you know, all your inside jokes. And I loved that so much but I didn't really start writing until my last year of college. I was just a bad actor until then. Bad, but happy.
What was your favorite play that you acted in?
Oh, No Exit.
No Exit. Wow.
I found it. I used to get cast as like the girlfriend, or like the yeah, like the girlfriend, like the like good nature or whatever. And then somebody was like, I think you got some darkness in you. And I was like, I do. And they asked me as Inez. And I was like, I feel alive. There was something that like, yeah, it was like my favorite. Like I got permission. I think I was trying to cover up where I came from and what I, you know, like the Jerseyisms that I, or whatever. And like, I got to just be brash and honest and play Inez, who just like was call people on their bullshit. And that was so fucking fun and something, yeah, I guess got unleashed there. And it was like, it was actually, I think the last show that I was in. Oh, also I got laryngitis right before performances. So I couldn't talk for the like 3 days that we were presenting the show. And so it actually ended up being a really fun, kind of cool thing because I would still act the stuff, but there would be like the stage manager behind me reading the actual lines.
Oh my God. That sounds amazing. Actually,
great. Yeah.
Brilliant theatrical concept. Yeah. That sounds very avant-garde. Wow.
It was great. It was fun. And I was like, I just love like these ridiculous, like fun ways that you problem solve together, you know, and all this collaborative, and you're like, we have to, we're going up this week. We can't like, you know, do it later. This is when we had the theater. So we just figure it out. Stage manager is going to read your lines.
We couldn't afford the understudy.
That's right.
It's you.
Yeah. I was like downtown theater.
Yes. Very downtown. And so I know you mentioned in this period, you were reading a lot of plays and they didn't have formal playwriting classes.
There was, I think, one, two, maybe like workshop classes where they weren't teaching, like there was like a theater history class where you could learn about certain plays and obviously, you know, Shakespeare classes and things like that. But there was like one or two or one a year, like playwriting workshop classes, which sort of, I was surprised they had because it seemed kind of at that time really off brand. Mm-hmm. So I took one, but it was mostly like the instruction was like, right, 10-minute scenes. And we were like, well, okay. And we were like, well, I don't know, we'll just give it a try. And then we like read them and get a few comments. And that was sort of it. But, you know, it's fine. It's good.
I know you had a fellowship that allowed you to stay in Chicago for 2 years after. And you were reading a lot of plays. Can you tell me about what was speaking to you at that time and whose work you were really drawn to at the time?
Yeah, I hadn't read a lot of contemporary plays, I guess, by the time I'd graduated, you know, but when I was about to graduate, I was also in another fucking panic of like, I still wanted to be a playwright. I started writing my last year or pretty late in college, and I found it so difficult and worthwhile. And I felt like I started to understand myself and the world more by doing it, even though it was incredibly difficult. And I was like, I want to do this. I'm going to do this the rest of my life. And I was like, how do I do that?
That's so amazing that you were so clear, like it like came to you so clearly early on.
Well, it didn't feel early for me. It felt so late. I feel like a lot of people came, I mean, you know, even where they were going to apply to school, like they knew what they wanted to do. And I felt like I was so late and it gave me such anxiety. Or maybe people just seemed like they put up a good front of like they knew what they were doing, but
right.
I was like, I don't know what the fuck. So I found out that there was this fellowship called the Mirage Foundation for the American Dream that gave I think like 10 or so students who were immigrants who were born in another country who were going to certain universities. We were the only ones who could apply for this fellowship, which was it was just like money. It was basically just money to quote unquote pursue our American dream. And I was like, I want to be a writer. That's my American dream. And I got it. And I think I was one of the very few, if not maybe their first artist or writer, playwright that got it. Most of the people were using it to go to grad school, to go to med school or engineering school or whatever they were doing. And so I was like, I have this organized institutional fellowship. So I should be as organized and institutional as I can and make a plan, because it wasn't as clear to me as like, well, I'm obviously using it for tuition in the way is that these people are. So I decided to make my own graduate program for the 2 years that the fellowship period was for. So what I did was I decided to stay in Chicago, which I didn't realize was such a healthy, friendly place for playwrights. I was like a happy accident that I ended up going to a place that was a very theater loving and theater rich place. So I spent half the week working at a bar and doing a bunch of part-time work so that I could just afford my rent, and everything else, the other funds I used to kind of fund my own study. So I spent a lot of time at the library, the Chicago Public Library, and just read all of these plays. I like pillaged their drama section. And then I took a few like theater classes at some theaters in town, which were also tended to be workshops. And I think less than learn, you know, I just was practicing writing, less than like learning about writing or learning, you know, having somebody teach me. It was useful to like make a community of writers and other theater makers and just like see theater and try to write and keep writing.
Did you go to Steppenwolf?
Yeah. And it was like, so, cause you can get like $15 tickets. You can get $5 tickets. Like it was, I'm so glad that like it was Chicago that I was in when I first it felt so much more accessible just for the price point. And there were wonderful people that I met. I didn't do any internships cause I couldn't afford. I couldn't afford to devote hours of free work, but I could read scripts. And so I made friends with the literary managers and asked if I could read scripts and evaluate scripts for them. And that was really useful for me to learn new writing as well. But I like when you asked, like there were things that I really responded to, I think I was just so excited to find that the world of playwriting was so big. Like, I mean, the first time I read a Stephen Anagyrgis play, I was so fucking excited because I felt like there was somebody who captured the mouths of the people that I grew up with. And that was, I found that to be like an invitation to me that I could, the more I read and the more I found people that were accessing parts of the world that I'd grown up in or things that I related to, I felt, you know, like we joke, like I feel seen, but I did. Like, I was like, oh, there's a place for these stories and for these people and for my stories. You know, when I first started writing, I was like, who's going to care about, you know, my family or like where we come from, or my mom cleaning houses. I just hadn't seen that as much. And that was really useful. And it was also really useful to like encounter plays that I felt like got it wrong, that wrote about, you know, people that I'd grown up with or my family or whatever, people I felt close to. It was useful because that also kind of galvanized me to be like, well, I should remedy this. Maybe I should contribute my voice into this and tell a fuller version of what I see written here.
At that time, when you're those 2 years, did you have any like readings or did you finish any scripts?
I did because I knew it was like a 2-year fellowship. I was like, oh, fuck, what the hell am I going to do after the 2 years? And so I was like, well, I'm going to go to grad school or I'm going to try to, and I'm going to only go to a grad school that's fully funded. So I found out what I needed for that. And they were like, well, you need a play. I was like, right, cool. Should write a play. I only had like my thesis play at that point, which I did not want to submit because I knew it was really bad. But like, bless them, they were encouraging. It was like 3.5 hours long and just like, oh yeah.
I would really like to see that play actually.
No, never, never will ever see that play. Never. So I kind of made a pact with myself, similar to like applying for the fellowship, that I needed to, if I wanted to be a playwright, which seemed like such a crazy, crazy fucking unstable bananas idea, then I had to make sure that there was somebody who was paying for that. Like I had to make sure that it was a job. So like I had this fellowship for 2 years and I was like, okay, well the fellowship will be over after these 2 years. So you better make a plan for who will now pay you to be a playwright. And that was grad school. And so my second year I was working on a play, my submission play basically. And I had readings at theaters, like some of the storefront theaters in Chicago. And I didn't know what the fuck I was doing either. I'd just been on the other side of the table, like as an actor in college. And usually you're working with Sartre, old plays that like the playwright's not there. So I didn't know what the hell to do in a reading, which was what grad school ended up being really, really good for. But yeah, I had a few readings with friends and at some of the storefront theaters in Chicago, and they were very encouraging. And I submit the play I was working on to grad schools and thankfully got in. And I was like, okay, cool. I can be a playwright for 3 more years because that's how long this grad school program is. And then I'll figure it out. We'll figure the next one out after.
did you have a sense of what the life of a playwright was like? I mean, I know you mentioned you felt like it was like a crazy idea, but did you feel like you understood what a life in the theater would be like?
I think I just knew that it was like, this will be difficult. I didn't know the specificity of like how. And I guess living in Chicago, I hadn't met, I don't think, anybody who was just a playwright at that time. I knew there were, the most of the people that I met were, they were doing some playwriting, but they were also like, you know, a CPA during the day, or they were trying to be a playwright. So that was my understanding of it then. When I told my mom that I wanted to be a playwright, she begged me if I could just be like a journalist instead, because she thought like, well, they have offices. And she thought they'd have offices. So it made them seem more real and more stable somehow. But no, I don't think I really knew. But also, like, what is the life of a playwright? I think we all, you know, have different, you know, for a while I was working, still working at a bar when I graduated from grad school. And that was like that version of my playwright life. And like, there's a constant hustle, which I think doesn't leave the playwriting life, no matter where you are, it just kind of changes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe you know, no one ever knows what the life of a playwright is. It's a constantly evolving thing.
We keep it a secret so that we don't discourage people from trying to be playwrights. I can't let them know.
People are like, this is bad. Like, you're like, you want to do this? I'm like, yes. And then I'm like, oh, fuck, this is hard. I don't think anybody lied to me about like, it's going to be great. So easy. Don't worry.
When I was in college, I went to school for acting. And when I was in college too, my family, and even afterwards, they were always like, you could be a news anchor.
Right.
It's so weird that like our immigrant families in their minds, journalists or like, right, they're right next door to actors. They're like, yeah, that's the same thing, right? You're like, No, that's not the same.
Not the same thing, but like, bless them. They just wanted us to be safe.
Was there like ever a moment in those 2 years before grad school where you're like, you know, I can always quit now. I can always, was there ever a plan B in your head?
There wasn't a plan B, but there was the knowledge that I should probably fucking have one. But I didn't. I think if there were plan B, who knows, I might have ended up doing that. But then on the other hand, like, who knows, because I'm stubborn and maybe I would have figured out a way to be a playwright anyways. No, that was another terrifying thing, is I didn't fucking know what else to do. I would joke for a while that if, you know, playwriting didn't work out, I could always go to law school, but that's not a guarantee either. Like, you know.
That's a lot of years,
you know, like, also it's a very, you know, we have a lot of lawyers. Maybe I'd be bad at it, or who knows? Like, there's so much shit that doesn't have a guarantee. And like, this time that we're in right now is just, you know, punctuates that we don't know.
Totally. And was Yale hard for you, or did it feel like a natural place for you to be?
I don't know. It would be a natural place, I guess. I feel like we have to like live in a lot of different worlds. Or I feel like we do live in a lot of different worlds. Maybe it's the, you know, the being born in a different place and having one foot here and one foot another. Yeah, I don't know. Do you feel that? Like, do you feel there's like a place that is like the most, like, I feel comfortable here?
I feel like there are places where I feel welcomed, where I feel like people are like, please come in. And then there are places where I have to kind of look around the room and make space for myself, or stand uncomfortably by a wall for a little while.
Yeah. I think, yeah, then maybe on those terms, yeah, I kind of stood uncomfortably by a wall. It was the wall was further away at Chicago than the wall was at Yale. I think by that, because at that point I was like, I gotta make this shit work. Well, you've decided you're a playwright, so you know 3 fucking years you're gonna do this. You're gonna do it here. But it felt like an imposter, definitely, for sure. When I got there, I was like, who the fuck am I? And I tried to write differently. And I don't even know why. When I first started writing, I would write about my family and my friends and the people I grew up with. And then when I got to Yale, and also that was my like writing sample play was that as well. I was writing about my mom and how we grew up, but in sort of a more fantastical way. And then when I got to YSD, I don't know why I felt like I was like, okay, I can't do that anymore. I'm supposed to, I don't know, be a serious playwright, or I don't know, be a more academic playwright. But that was, I guess, you know, that was part of it. I was what, like 23 or something, 24 maybe, when I 23, I think, when I got there. So I'm also like, fuck, that was young. you know, like be like, and now you're writing.
Did you try to like emulate a different voice? How did you write? What was the attempt to fit in, or I don't know, be at Yale?
I think I tried to write like worlds that were not our world. Like, so I wouldn't like say where they were. There were a lot of like isolated houses. I'm like, I don't know what they were. I don't know why. Like magical houses where, but like probably if somebody read them now, they'd be like, oh, right. This character is an immigrant, or this character is a displaced person. And this character is going through, oh, look, there's some domestic violence here. Like, you know, there's things that I was just, I think I was trying to hide with a mask, or I was, mm-hmm. maybe I thought I was trying to get to something deeper and more honest by wearing a mask, which I think is true. And it's also sort of what I do now. Like I'm all the characters, right? But like, it's easier to access certain things about yourself when you feel safe. So wearing the mask of like, oh, this character is in their 50s and a male and whatever things that like make it seem like they're not me. Sometimes I'm able to access some like a more shared humanity that it feels more universal, more specific to me when I know that people aren't going to be like, oh, well, that's obviously the Martina character in the play. And so maybe I was trying to do that also and do it in a form that felt like theatrical. And I wanted to please Paula Vogel for sure. She was, I so respected her and looked up to her, and I wanted to, I don't know, write theatrical plays for her, I guess. And I'm sure she just wanted me to write myself. And I was, there was like a process of me learning what that was, I think in grad school.
Did you write Ironbound in grad school?
No, I wrote that right out of YSD the year after. None of the plays that I'd written, like I say going anywhere, but it's because I also wasn't really sending them out. I think I could tell that I was not writing like myself, even though I felt like I wasn't the time. And I had it was another sort of difficult period when I graduated from YSD, because I had moved, I had to move out. I had very little money. I'd moved to New York, and it was so difficult to just get my feet on the ground. And I was like, I don't know that I can do this. Like I've put the work into studying. I've done all that. But I have no safety net. I have no financial safety net. If this doesn't work out, I have nothing to fall back on. And so I was like, maybe this isn't for you. Again, another moment of like, this might not be for you. But I asked myself, what would I have regret not having said if I gave up now? And I was like, well, I tried to write my mom's story and my story of growing up, like at that point twice. It was my thesis play at Chicago. It was my writing sample that I had written to get into grad school, and they just didn't feel like they got it. And so I gave myself a week and I wrote Ironbound and was like, okay, cool. Great. Now I can give up. Cause at least I have this, but I didn't know that at the time. I had a reading. I had to do it for a reading as part of, I had another fellowship that at that time I wasn't where it wasn't something that I was able to, it wasn't enough of money for me to do the same thing I did in Chicago, also because of how much more expensive the cost of living was in New York. But part of that fellowship was I got a reading, and the reading was at the Lark, which I hadn't heard of at that point. And it was a cold read, and people laughed and responded like pretty early in the play. And I was like, oh, there might be, oh, that means there's something here. People are responding. They're listening. They're laughing. Maybe there's value in this play after all. And that ended up being the play that opened some doors for me. It was my first production in New York. And then, you know, support came after that, like more, I was part of more writers groups, Women's Project, for example. And I had a fellowship from New York Theater Workshop, a 2050 fellowship. I applied to a lot of places, but it was really because of Ironbound and because of me being like, okay, this is it. This is your one chance. You have 1 week. Go write a play. Go write that play. And then you're done.
Did you get picked up right away, or did you have to like shop it around and pitch it to people?
It took a while. I wrote it in, I guess, 2013 or 14, somewhere around then. Oh, yeah, 2013 I wrote it. And it wasn't until 2016 that it was produced in New York. Before that, it had the world premiere in DC at the end of 2015. But yeah, it was, I found it took a lot longer to get that play produced than any play after that because it was the first play. Nobody knew me. I was a stranger and a new playwright. And so I was also learning the landscape of New York and the landscape of American theater. So it took a little bit longer. Yeah, I think, you know, it's also my experience at that time was that people wanted to wait and see if you'd been christened yet. They wanted to wait and see if you got validation from an award or something like that. So people would read the play because they were like, ah, she went to Yale School of Drama. So like that was a little stamp, I mean, a significant stamp that I felt grateful for and that I had. But, you know, we're all careful. People are careful. Like I get it.
Were you day jobbing before the production
Yeah, I think I cobbled together a lot of, I was working at bars, restaurants. What else was I doing? I was doing a little bit of like, here's a short teaching gig, you know, really just like, here's $200. Would you hand out pamphlets at this event? I was doing whatever I could do to make money, mostly restaurants and bars. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So in that time, like what was keeping you going? Did you carve out like you did in Chicago when you said, okay, I'm going to take these 2 years to, you know, sit down and write? In the time before your first production, were you like, okay, the gig is, I write from these hours to these hours. Do you have a ritual or a kind of schedule you set for yourself then and even now?
Definitely no. I did. I like pretend I do to make myself seem more legitimate, I think. And I'll be like, no, I can't do a Skype before 4. I'm writing or something just because I'm like, I've been doing a lot of phone calls or something. But you know, my first year in New York too, it was so hard to find the headspace to write because I was spending a lot of time acclimating myself to New York, figuring out, setting up a life here, trying to make money just to pay rent. My first year in New York, I hopped between 13 different sublets because I didn't have enough for a security deposit when I first moved. And like 3 months in, got bed bugs because that sublet had them, but they didn't tell me. It was a rough, like, welcome to New York, period. So like while I was carting, you know, my like bed bug infested belongings and trash bags between like storage units and like trying to find new sublets and going to my like bartending job and my like waitressing job, I was not writing like full length play, but I was writing short pieces because I was involved with Youngblood at EST. And sidebar, I was also applying to a lot of opportunities, writers groups and fellowships and things like that, because a lot of them frankly just came with money. Some of them even came with health insurance, like Juilliard, for example, which I applied, or I was drawn to apply largely because of the health insurance. I mean, there are lots of other reasons, but that was a big draw. Mm-hmm. That's what took up a lot of time as well. So like, it was like survival, applying for like playwriting support that would give me some money that I could ideally at some point write something. And I had like a foot in the world of the theater by being a part of Youngblood, which met once a week. And they had these like short play festivals once a month. And that kept me writing. So I was like, okay, I can write 10 pages. And a lot of those 10 pages ended up actually becoming cost of living, was by just having like some connection and some accountability to being a writer, being a theater artist. So yeah, like I didn't really have a system at that point except for survival. And now it's like, now I like have an apartment. I mean, I rent it, but like I'm not at that place with way more security than at that point. But now I'm sort of scrambling to do the work that I've like said yes to. At a certain point, there was a period where I had to say yes to everything, and now I'm at a place where I'm having to say no to certain things and yes to the right things as opposed to yes to everything. And I have a few commissions that are open-ended. They're like, write something, write us a play that I have to finish, and some TV and film work that I'm doing also. And I just have to get through it. And it's all stuff I want to be doing. I'm just finding it difficult, or I have actually for a long time found it difficult. I'm getting somewhat of a routine now, but I found it difficult to like, how do you work on 7 different things. You know, you can't work on all of those things at the same time or at the same level. And I feel like every week is different. Like, it's like, this week is the week that I do this. And then I send that project out and wait for its next step. Usually it's like notes or waiting for somebody to read it. And then I go onto the next. And then you're always aware that you have all these projects that, so when you like encounter something in the world, like you've read a book or an article, or you've talked to somebody or heard an anecdote or a song or seen a film, it might inspire you. It might like sort of be the thing that fills the well for when it's time to work on that particular project. And so it's always working, but I'm trying to balance and juggle different things at the same time. But you're never really doing that. You're just, you know, that at a certain point, like this week is the week I'm going to do this, or this day is the day that I'm going to do this. And you've been quote unquote working on it by living and by taking stuff in and like gestating with it until it's time to work on that particular thing.
I feel like
I wish I had a schedule that I could like follow in that always worked, but you don't know. Sometimes too, you'd set the time aside and then you're like, fuck, I don't know what I'm writing. I don't know how to do this.
Nope, not in the mood. I'd rather wash the dishes.
Okay, I'm never in the mood. Like I'm never like, ah, what a lovely day. I think I'll stare in front of this like computer and sit for hours. And like, I found it so difficult, but it's easier when you like know what the purpose of it is. Like you're like, oh, I'm telling the story to say this, or like I know the exact form, and then you can kind of feel freer to write within that. But like, oh man, no, I'm never like, God, I can't wait to write today.
Yeah. But that, I feel like, I mean, you won a Pulitzer 2 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And looking from the outside, it's like, wow, the distance from doing Ironbound and graduating from Yale to winning a Pulitzer seems like a very short distance. I mean, it is a very short distance. And people who win Pulitzers are usually, you know, maybe not usually, but it's such a big prize. And a lot of people are way, way late in their careers when they win them. And so just thinking about that, when you were in the world of surviving and living from paycheck to paycheck, what was the advice or the thing you clung on to keep you going? Or that you, thinking about that now, like when you think about young people who are starting out and trying to make it to their next play or reading or whatever
thing that you would offer them.
Oh, I find advice so difficult because it's always autobiographical. You know, it's like, in fact, sometimes when I give advice, it's like, this is what I wish I'd done, or like, this is what I'd done, what I had done. And I'm so curious about what this time is gonna, how it's gonna change the landscape. Like I'm just, particularly this pandemic. And I mean, I'm like, how do I, what's gonna happen with the theater? We don't know. So it's like, I already feel like whatever advice I'd have is outdated, you know, potentially too, because I want advice to figure out what we're doing now. All I know to do is to keep writing and keep working on the things that I've been working on. But I think honestly, I didn't have a backup plan. I had to make it work. I was constantly reminded in my daily life and in my past what it costs to do this, to want to be a writer and to want to tell stories. And I felt like I'd already sacrificed all of these things. And I was given these opportunities that it felt like if I couldn't squander them at this point. There was a guilt actually of like, well, you know, people invested in your education. And so you better make it work. Also, like, what else are you going to do? You only have one life. This is your finite life. And okay, it's hard. Great. So figure it out. If it's so meaningful to you, figure out a way to make it work. And it sounds brutal, but I'm like just learning to have more compassion for myself. But actually, I think at that time it was useful. It's useful now also. I struggle with projects all the time. And I guess it's just reminding myself that it's always cost something to do this. And that I guess isn't going to stop. It just evolves. And I just love the rehearsal room so much. And I love working on theater. I love working in the theater and working with actors and other collaborators and directors. I remind myself of that and how much I love that and that I can only do that if I've written something. And also, I think as much as I find this difficult, I think that it's also so difficult to not write, to like not have that thing to, I don't know, funnel oneself into, like time their time and their work and effort. And also, like, I feel like I get to know myself more through writing than I do, like, by not writing. I just, it's not therapy. It's not, it just feels like it's, there's like some truth that I'm not able to access until I've gone through the process of having written about it. And sometimes I don't even know what that thing is, but it's usually figured out through the rehearsal room or sometimes on opening night, or sometimes I don't figure it out, but it's like, it's a constant question that I know that I have. And I mean, the only practical advice that I think is useful no matter what is to read plays if you want to be a playwright. I mean, to just like, to know what's out there and who's writing what, and not even like what playwright is, like to know playwrights, but just like in the way that I found there to be a home for my stories and the people that I write about by discovering certain playwrights like Stephen Alec Yergis and, oh God, I don't know, I'm rambling again.
No, you're great.
I don't know. I'd bow back up and say, like, I think no matter what, reading plays and like learning more about theater and the theater is always useful because it's going to be inspiring one way or the other. Either you're going to want to remedy what you feel like somebody did wrong, or you're going to be inspired to like to add your voice to what is already out there and where you feel like your stories might be missing, or you're going to find that there are people who come from similar places that are also writing, and you're going to feel like there's a little home there for you. So that's the only, like, reading is the only thing that I can be like, yep, that's definitely like advice that I would give anybody. Otherwise, it's also specific to certain times and to myself.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Martina.
Oh my gosh, so we did it.
We did it. We did it.
That was Martina Myok. Thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please share it with a friend or recommend it to a colleague, a student, whoever you know. It's the only way people learn about the show because I am so bad at publicizing it. I appreciate you. Thank you. Have a great day and stay safe.